Since the end of 2019, overall bank multifamily lending has grown by about 30% in the United States as the asset class has soared in popularity thanks to enormous demand. And while office has taken so much of the attention in recent years about assets and trouble, multifamily is facing a growing default risk. It's hard to believe in a housing crisis, but rents in some places of the United States are stagnating, and many of the apartment buildings that are built in those areas were fueled by cheap debt. I'm Miriam Hall. I'm PERE's America's editor. In our cover story this month, I explored the issues facing the sector. Now, the story that's out now and available on PERE's website takes a deep dive into the operators who are likely to be caught out and the kinds of opportunities that this situation may present. On this episode of Spotlight, we're taking a closer look at the bank exposure. You're hearing from Brian Tees, who's with the North American Banks team at Fitch Ratings, as well as Christopher Wolfe, who's also with the North American Banks team. I began by asking Brian if he thinks the narrative around multifamily is shifting.
So I don't know that it's the narrative changing, but it is an asset class that has maybe flown under the radar a bit. It is a class within CRE that has seen significant growth over the last 4 years. And as such, most of that was underwritten at extremely low interest rates. So now, as a lot of that is coming up for refinance, it's doing so at significantly higher rates. There's been significant expense inflation over the last several years. So that combined, can pressure the debt service coverage ratios of some of these borrowers. You know, I think where we see sort of the most acute risks at the moment are in the rent stabilized and rent controlled space, as well as some markets that have seen significant run up in supply over the last couple of years that may have outstripped demand. I know in our recent webinar, we basically across groups at Fitch, we all cited the Sun Belt states as areas where we've seen some of that activity.
Chris, what do you think? Have you noticed a narrative shift?
Yeah, again, I'd agree with Brian. I don't think that's so much a narrative shift. I think it's just that office has probably taken the spotlight for some time, given some of the structural changes. And I think now we're starting to see a little bit more focus on multifamily for the reasons Brian had pointed out. But also, you saw a lot of growth in multifamily over the last couple of years. So I think that is, the performance is still looking good, but the growth is probably masking what's underneath. And I think that's the point about, so much of this was done in a low rate environment. Now, when some of these loans have to come up for refinance, what's that going to mean in terms of the borrower's ability to service the debt?
I was really surprised by the number of just the jump in banks lending on multifamily since the pandemic. Could you quantify it for me a little bit?
So since the end of 2019, overall bank multifamily lending has grown by approximately 30%.
Which is high. That's a significant jump, right?
No, yeah, because normally you would see, even where some banks were growing significantly, you'd see pullback in others and there'd be sort of a give and take, but that's aggregate lending across the U.S. banking industry.
And that's just driven by the fact that there is so much interest in housing. There was so much a rush to build.
A couple things probably there, which is, single family housing, there had been, some run up in prices. So I think, it was pricing some people out of some families out of the market. So I think, that they turned to rental. And I also think multifamily, if you kind of look back over time, has generally had, performed better than some of the other subsectors within commercial real estate. So when you think of like office or other areas or retail, multifamily has had a pretty good track record for some time, which has probably also made it more attractive for banks to grow there versus other segments of the CRE.
In our cover story this month that's out now, which I looked at multifamily, and it's kind of set as a sort of surprise problem child for private real estate. It has been such a good performer and been so reliable, but people are starting to see some of the issues that you raise, problems in the Sun Belt, issues with certain asset classes. Could you tell me about which banks have the most exposure to multifamily? It seems like it's quite concentrated.
So if we look across the top 10 multifamily lenders in the U.S., they hold together approximately 40% of all bank multifamily loans. From there, there's a bit of a divergence, though, where the with the largest banks, two that we cited in our recent report being, J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo. For those largest banks, even though they hold a large portion of the multifamily loans in the U.S., it represents a relatively small portion of their balance sheet. On the other hand, there are banks, more in the regional bank space where those concentrations are materially higher. Call it, greater than 15% of total lending at the bank.
Right. So that's just the nature of the size of those outfits. Like JP
Yes.
Morgan's just so big. So is there a bank that you would say this is a concern? I mean, when we look at, say, Flagstar, they have the highest portion of non-performing loans. Can you walk me through that and whether or not that is something of a concern?
Yeah, I think it is a concern. And I think the concern for them is both the concentration, which they've always had. So, I mean, that's not a new thing. But what's changed for them is that they're a little bit more focused in what we would say is rent-controlled or rent-stabilized properties. Now, historically, that would be a decent place to be because the vacancy, the occupancy rates were always very high. So almost, 98% over time. So the properties tended to perform very well despite the economic cycles. Now, what changed for that segment of the market, particularly in New York City, and but in other jurisdictions as well, is the rent control laws and rent stabilization laws were changed, which made them more tenant friendly, which meant it was harder to pass on any increases in cost in terms of the tenants. And that's where I think there's going to be a little bit more of a challenge that didn't used to exist, but I think will now, someone like a Flagstar will have to confront, which is even if you underwrote carefully, you had, low or reasonable LTVs, the debt service coverage ratios are going to start to get pinched. And so that's where I think you're going to see, that's really where the challenge, I think, lies.
Because you're talking about New York rent stabilized properties, which we have seen some extraordinary losses, some sales recently that are quite mind-boggling. I saw one property that was sold on the Upper West Side recently for about $35 million when the purchase price was $80 million, and it's because of the nature of the fact that it's rent stabilized. But Brian, you said that Sunbelt kept coming up, and that is a totally different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I think in a lot of those markets, the story has been just the amount of supply that has been brought online in those markets over the last, 4 to 5 years compared to, where demand expectations were. On top of that, to the extent that these loans were underwritten, during the construction phase to trended rents, if the rent growth expectations have not met those trends at underwriting, it can cause debt service coverage issues when moving to permanent financing from construction financing.
At the end of last year, there were 49 banks with elevated levels of non-performing multifamily mortgages, according to Fitch. Now, those banks are relatively small, averaging $1.3 billion in total assets. So the contagion risk, if one of those banks were to fail, is moderated. And Brian points out there's much more regulation on the banks now compared to the GFC.
Bank underwriting has changed significantly since before the financial crisis, especially on CRE loans in general. There's a lot more equity requirements up front, and so there will be less tendency to get fully over their skis if it becomes a problem. There's just more, call it, headroom there, whether that equity is sufficient to make up for losses if we really do experience the level of CRE losses that some have predicted is a different question, but there's definitely more there than there would have been in the early to mid 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, we do talk about how much more regulated the banks are. How much are non-bank lenders, though, playing in this space, and how much regulation do they really face?
I don't have the we can, I don't have the data in terms of what the non-bank, especially if it were focused on multifamily.
But is that something to consider?
It is, but they're not, you know, to your question, they're not regulated. So, you know, they can underwrite however they choose and risk manage however they choose. Whereas for the banks, you do have, you know, prudential regulators that would be, you know, coming through and challenging, you know, the banks on underwriting and risk management. So I think to Brian's point about the GFC, I think that the difference there is, you know, there was very poor underwriting. It was almost like originate to sell. So basically that was the thought was, I don't really care about the loan quality. I'm just going to sell it. And there was very poor risk management on that after the fact. So banks didn't really have good insights as to the concentrations and the things that, you know, potentially within their portfolios compared to today, where I think that's to Brian's point earlier, I think there is, you know, a good underwriting, good discipline, but what's changed is the rate environment. And I think more to the office sector, just a structural change in terms of how often people are going to the office. So that's something that was, when you underwrote in 2018, you could not have easily have predicted.
Would you say the era of extend and pretend is over?
It depends on what you mean by extend and pretend. So, I mean, extending a loan could be a good work, you know, a good economic way to work out a loan. So, you know, that could reduce, you know, your losses, meaning is it better to work with the borrower in some capacity or just take over the property and then foreclose on it and sell it? So I think it's a little bit of an economic decision that has to get made. To us, the question is always, if you're restructuring a loan, have you restructured the loan enough and taken sufficient loss to account for that so that the loan can now be a performing loan down the road? And that's the question, I think, whenever you see that happen, is the bank taking sufficient loss in that process?
Brian, what do you think?
No, I would echo Chris's sentiment there. The banks do have capacity to, you know, work with borrowers, especially when, you know, the impairment is considered to be temporary in nature as opposed to, you know, a real structural shift. You know, I think the danger there is that they would get into that extend and pretend mode for, you know, things that have materially changed and are not going to be improving over time, you know. And I think that, you know, that danger of sort of pretending would be probably more prominent, you know, in the office space, just because we do see something of a structural shift there as opposed to, you know, more of a rate-driven stumble.
In our cover story, there's one figure that suggests that there are $18 billion to $20 billion of what's known as truly distressed multifamily loans nationally at the moment. And Brian and Christopher think the next 12 to 24 months will be when those challenged loans shake out.
The tenor of these loans tends to be between, you know, 5 to 10 years. And so that cohort that was started growing in 2020, many of those will be coming up for renewal. So broadly speaking, across the industry, there is likely to be a fairly large cohort coming up for refinance in the next 12 months.
That was the vintage that was really financed at in a different era.
Yeah, at near zero rates.
Yeah. So is it this year that is the big, I guess, hump to get through?
I mean, I would say, you know, if you're talking about just the sort of financed right as rates fell, that would be the next 12 to 24 months.
Yeah, it goes back to, I think, you know, even if these were underwritten well with, you know, good LTVs, those LTV cushions have come down significantly or will come down as they come up for, you know, reappraisal. But it's really the debt service coverage, which I think is where the vulnerability is. Meaning, you know, when banks underwrite, you know, you're going to want some cushion on your debt service. And even if they underwrote to a higher interest rate, so let's just say you underwrote to a higher rate, you probably didn't underwrite to a 500 basis point increase. So, you know, even if you put in a 200 basis point buffer in your underwriting, just given where rates are, your borrower might still have a tough time servicing the loan. So I think it comes down to debt service. And I think that's where we're going to see more of the, you know, the challenges. And so you'll end up seeing, you know, banks having to classify, you know, these loans more, I think more for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just to add on to that point, as that debt service coverage falls, because of the regulatory focus on that ratio, either the regulators or the banks themselves can end up being forced to classify loans that are still performing. You know, we could see increases in classifieds from, you know, loans that are still currently to date, but the performance has deteriorated.
That's Brian Tees, and before him, Christopher Wolf, both with the North American bank team at Fitch Ratings. A link to my story about the multifamily market is available in the show notes. I'm Miriam Hall. Thanks for listening.